Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're opening up a really pivotal and often sanitized piece of American religious history. Mm-hmm. We are focused squarely on Joseph Smith's earliest known career, treasure digging.
Right. And when you encounter the official narratives, this whole period is, you know, it's pushed into the background, it's dismissed.
Just a footnote, right. Yeah. Some kind of regional folk superstition.
Exactly. But that narrative, well, it fundamentally obscures the truth. Our source material today, and this includes documents the church has been forced to acknowledge, like the Joseph Smith papers, It argues this era is far from a footnote.
It's the starting point.
It's the essential starting point. Understanding his life as a treasure digger, it establishes his reputation, his methods, and, you know, the foundational expectations of his earliest followers. It really is the first crucial puzzle piece.
So our mission today is pretty straightforward. We need to move past the simple fact that Joseph Smith was a treasure digger. We need to understand why the specific methods, the lore, and the, frankly, insidious psychological tactics of this 19th century confidence game are just completely inseparable from the faith that followed.
Okay, so let's start with the central tool. We know, and this is now an undisputed historical fact, it's attested to by official church institutions like BYU, and the Joseph Smith Papers Project, that Joseph Smith used what he called a seer stone.
Or a peep stone.
Or a peep stone, right?
And what was the procedure? Because it's often shown in modern church art as this very spiritual, reverent practice.
Historically, it was anything but. The procedure involved placing this small stone into a stovepipe hat, then pulling the hat up to his face.
To block out the light?
To block out all the outside light, exactly. He'd then claim he could see visions within the stone itself. Visions that revealed, you know, the location of lost objects, buried gold, that sort of thing.
So he wasn't really looking at the stone so much as using the hat as a dark room.
That's a perfect way to put it. A makeshift dark room to facilitate the vision.
What's so fascinating here is that our sources show this wasn't some innocent local quirk. Educated people at the time knew this was a calculated fraud.
Oh, absolutely.
We can look back at someone like Benjamin Franklin writing about this decades before Joseph Smith was even born.
Exactly. Franklin, writing in the 1720s, 1730s, he saw this practice as highly destructive. He wrote about how honest laboring people would just abandon their work.
Fueled by this hope of getting rich quick.
Right, this vain hope of growing suddenly rich. And they'd neglect their families and, in his words, ruin themselves, searching for these imaginary hidden treasures.
So it wasn't just seen as naive, it was causing real social harm, economic exploitation. And Franklin even identified the classic escape hatch, the failure mechanism, didn't he?
He laid out the blueprint for the scammer. The massive hole gets dug, weeks are spent, and when nothing's found, the diggers are told that, oh, through some mistake in the procedure, some rash word spoke, the guardian spirit just sank the treasure deeper.
It's an immediate deflection of blame.
Instant. It's never the seer's fault. It's always the followers.
Wow. So every element, the huge investment of labor, the failure, and then blaming the followers, it's all perfectly described by an educated American, what, 50 years before?
And this was so well known as a scam that they had to make laws against it. Joseph Smith wasn't operating in some gray area. He was doing something that was already legally understood to be fraudulent.
Let's just nail down the context. His whole reputation was built on this, really, through the 1820s. So from about 1820 right up until 1827.
The year he claims to get the plates. Mm-hmm. And this all exists inside what historians call the magic worldview.
What does that mean exactly?
It's a belief system where, you know, spiritual power wasn't just in the church. It could be accessed through special objects, special rituals. The power was in the object itself, the seer stone.
Kind of like the Palantir in Lord of the Rings, an object that shows you things, but you need a charismatic interpreter to use it.
That's a great analogy. Exactly. Joseph the seer wasn't just talking to God. He was interpreting the magical object. His charisma, his reputation for controlling the stone, that's what kept the whole enterprise going.
So let's move to the physical reality of it all. I mean, these weren't small holes in the ground.
No, not at all. Our sources describe them as massive digs. We're talking huge excavations into hillsides, like Miner's Hill. These were operations that could last for weeks, sometimes more than a month.
Serious, sustained operations. Funded.
Yes, funded by investors.
Yeah.
And that investment of time and money, it just raises the stakes.
Yeah.
Once you spent weeks digging, your desire to believe it's magnified.
Mm.
But the methods to guarantee success got pretty dark.
This is where we get into the animal sacrifice. What does the historical evidence actually tell us?
We have multiple independent accounts, at least half a dozen. They detailed the need for animal sacrifice to appease the spirits guarding the treasure.
The idea being that these were, what, evil spirits?
Malevolent spirits, okay. Yeah. They had to be appeased or neutralized.
And what did that look like in practice?
The accounts are grim. They mention killing dogs. One account specifically talks about portray, or sometimes a black goat or sheep.
And then what?
The animal's blood would be sprinkled around the dig site. The ritual was meant to take off the charm or break the enchantment that was protecting the gold.
Yeah.
It was a deeply disturbing, violent part of the folk magic he was involved in.
That is heavy. But let's move to the clearest proof that this wasn't just failed magic, that it was overt, deliberate fraud. This comes from the Josiah Stoll dig.
Right. This is one of the most damning pieces of evidence, because this is active deception. Joseph Smith, staring into his hat, he claims to see a specific treasure chest. He describes it, says there's a feather resting on top of it.
Okay.
So the digging party works for days. They get to the spot and they find the feather.
Right.
But the treasure chest, of course, is gone.
And why is that feather absolute, undeniable proof of fraud?
Because feathers are organic. They disintegrate. If that chest had been buried for centuries, or even just a few decades, that feather would be gone. Dust.
It would be unrecognizable.
Utterly. For them to find a clear, intact feather means Joseph Smith, or someone working with him, had to have planted it there recently.
So it was a physical prop, a piece of stagecraft to manipulate the diggers.
Exactly. It's physical evidence to convince them, see, the treasure was real, we were right here, but the magic was too strong, and the treasure sank because you weren't worthy enough. It was a tactic to keep the investors invested.
And speaking of investment, we have to tackle that claim that he didn't really make much money doing this.
Yeah, the no financial motivation argument. The math tells a very different story. Joseph Smith himself admitted he made $14 a month from this work.
And how does that compare to, say, a regular farm laborer at the time?
Well, a typical farm laborer in upstate New York around 1827 was earning maybe $8 or $9 a month.
So he was earning over 50% more than the average honest worker. He wasn't just scratching out a living.
Precisely. For a young, uneducated man, putting a rock in a hat and telling other people where to dig was a highly lucrative career. The financial incentive was absolutely there.
And all of this, it came to a head in court, right? Let's jump to the 1826 trial.
Yes, the 1826 trial in South Bainbridge, New York. It started because Josiah Stoll's nephew, Peter Bridgman, saw his uncle was being just financially drained. So he filed a formal complaint.
And that forced Joseph Smith to defend his methods in a court of law.
He had to defend his use of the seer stone against charges of essentially being a con man.
And the result of that trial is something apologetic scholars dreaded for decades. There's that famous Hugh Nibley quote.
Right. Nibley, who was one of the most prominent apologists for the church, he called the 1826 court record the most damning evidence in existence against Joseph Smith.
And that carries so much weight coming from him. He knew what it implied.
He did. For over a century, the church actively denied the trial even happened. They denied the treasure digging, they paid scholars to discredit the evidence, and they literally hid the seer stone in a vault.
Hoping to just erase the history.
But history prevailed. The evidence just became overwhelming. And today, the church, through the Joseph Smith Papers Project, has been forced to acknowledge the trial records.
Including the docket entry?
Including the docket entry stating Joseph Smith was found guilty of being a disorderly person, of fraudulent activities.
So the foundation of the faith rests on a man who, right before the Book of Mormon, was legally confirmed to be a charlatan.
That's the takeaway from the historical sources.
Mm-hmm.
His reputation wasn't just as a local seer, it was as a legally convicted fraudster.
So what does that foundation of fraud mean for the religion that followed? Well, let's connect the dots, because the transfer of methods it's just so direct.
It's a wholesale transfer. You take the two main components of the treasure hunt and just repurpose them. First, the guardian spirit protecting the gold.
Becomes the angel Moroni guarding the plate.
Exactly. And second, the method of looking into a stone in a hat to see treasure.
Becomes the method for translating the gold plates to see words. The procedure is identical. Stone in a hat, face covered, visions.
The name changes, but the mechanism is the same 19th century folk magic ritual. And this lore, it wasn't just procedural. It was absorbed directly into the Book of Mormon itself.
Can you give us an example from the text?
Sure. Look at Helaman, chapter 13. Nephi describes how riches will become slippery and the gold will slip away from the people because of a curse.
That's the exact language from the treasure digging folklore.
The exact language. The idea of slippery treasure was rampant in upstate New York. It meant the magic was making the treasure sink and evade the digger. It wasn't an ancient Nephite concept. It was a local 19th century magical concept.
And that influence, that magical worldview, it extends into the modern church, right? Specifically with the need for rituals to be performed exactly right.
That insistence on precision is a direct legacy.
Yeah.
In treasure digging, if you spoke one wrong word, the charm failed. The treasure slipped away.
And that becomes the sacrament prayer being said word for word.
Word for word. Or the strict temple rites, or making sure baptism is a full immersion. Any tiny failure in the ritual and the power fails.
Which brings us to maybe the most insidious legacy. Blame reversal. When the dig failed, Joseph blamed the diggers. It was their fault.
That mechanism is fundamental. It protects the seer. Joseph Smith essentially converted the physical treasure dig into a spiritual one. The covenant path.
The hunt for a chest of gold becomes the hunt for eternal salvation.
Right. And the huge advantage is that the seer never has to produce the reward in this lifetime. The promise can always be deferred.
And if the promised blessings, health, success, comfort, if they don't materialize in your life now,
the failure is always, always on you, the follower. Your lack of worthiness, your lack of faith, your lack of obedience. This mechanism maintains the prophet's authority, and it keeps the faithful digging on that spiritual treadmill, never realizing the whole framework is a tactic carried over from a 19th century fraud.
It's truly insightful. The treasure digging career isn't some messy footnote. It is the blueprint. It established the mechanisms of prophecy, the lore, and the psychological tactics that would define the entire movement.
So, as you think about all this, consider this. If the core mechanism of the treasure hunt was designed just to maintain the seer's power by shifting blame onto the followers, how much of your own life have you spent blaming yourself, feeling unworthy when promised blessings failed to show up?
Is this really a legacy of divine spiritual guidance? Or is it a sophisticated tactic carried over from the world of illegal 19th century fraud?
Mm-hmm.
Something serious to mull over. Join us for the next deep dive, where we move from the career of the treasure digger directly to the emergence of the gold plates themselves and see how these final puzzle pieces fit together.